Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 165, and the atmosphere in Xhosaland was ablaze with indignation. And Mr. Holliday had complained at Fort Beaufort that an Imadungi man called Tsili had stolen his axe, and if you recall last episode, Tsili had been arrested, then freed while under military escort by Tola, a headman who lived nearby. Tola had hacked off a prisoner's hand to free Tsili from his shackles. That poor prisoner was thrown into a nearby river and died. The British then demanded Tsili and Tola be handed over, but Imadungi chief Nkosi Botomani refused. Rarabi chief Sandile was approached, but he'd had enough of the English authorities and refused as well. This was ostensibly what set off the War of the Axe, or the War of the Boundary, as Amaxhosa called it. This war was fought over land, not an axe. And waiting for the British were the Xhosa warriors who had learned to fight with sticks from childhood. They were expert at downing passing birds with throwing spears, their intshuntshe, which were also used to kill game. The long haft would resonate, quiver and vibrate when it struck its target, the shaking adding to the power of penetration. Warriors carried more than half a dozen of these, although they were not accurate from beyond 30 meters. The last spear would be kept in hand, never thrown, as the commander shouted, "Pakati!" The warrior would break off the end, and hand-to-hand fighting would ensue. The other weapon which some warriors carried was a stabbing spear with a fearful serrated edge. They also carried a shield useless against bullets, but when the fighting was close, face to face, these shields were effective against the English bayonets. Each circumcision lodge saw young men gathering and stories of coming of age shared by the elders. Despite all of this, the Amaxhosa were not prone to full-tilt warfare. The usual business was raiding and counter-raiding. Before any war broke out, the councillors from both sides tended to try and sort out the conflict using diplomacy. These Amazaku-Zaku would hustle back and forth, keeping the warring chiefs updated. If the enemy was particularly untrustworthy, the Amaxhosa would send women, as it was not acceptable to kill women and children even in war. But if war was declared, the chief gathered his men at his great place. Subordinate chiefs were expected to provide the soldiers, and women would pass on the message from hill to hill using the ikoyili, a high-pitched call similar to that of a wild dog. The men would arm themselves and set off to the great place where the chief or the king had prepared slaughtered cattle. The warriors would eat. A briefing would take place about the causes of the war. Everyone would dance and sing. Then the men would be doctored for the coming battle. The war doctors like Inglele, who had attacked Grahamstown in 1819, were particularly important. Every chief had his own itola, who would drive the warriors into a frenzy of fierceness. Ukuklupeza. Fed on animals that are feared, medicine from snake poison or the gall of a bull. It was believed that the power of the animal could make a warrior more effective. They would be imbued with its strengths. Ivory armlets would be donned, or the claws of leopards and lions, or they'd wear a piece of skin from the wild animal. For protection from the enemy, the war doctors would prepare special concoctions to be rubbed into cuts in the warrior's skin, or swallowed, or both. The plumbago auriculata plant was used, along with geraniums, or pelargonium, if you prefer the scientific name. Often the warriors were sworn off sex before battles, and other ritual prohibitions would be instituted by the war doctors. The war doctor travelled with the army, and they were believed to have the power to call down thick mist, or to make warriors invisible. They'd keep a sharp eye out for birds that were believed to be bad luck, vultures, hamerkops, hammerheads, or even robins. The young warriors would lead this march. Behind would come the older men with the chief at the rear, along with his bodyguards, the Amafaninkosi, who would die for their chief. The Amafaninkosi would be deployed to ensure that the warriors fought properly, urging them on and preventing some from trying to flee. The chief's sons would normally lead sections of warriors, and he'd shout commands if the section was close enough, or send messengers if they were out of sight. Like the AmaZulu and other Nguni people, the army would break into three sections as the battle began. There's been much made of Shaka's head and two horns tactic, but as I've explained, this was not his invention. The Amaxhosa used the same technique. They used the center to strike, then the two wings, or amapiko, would attempt to outflank the enemy. Before colonization, the Amaxhosa mode of war was mainly aimed at seizing the enemy's cattle. Once that had been achieved, battle was over. After the 1820s, fighting was much more violent. Entire groups of warriors could be wiped out. In the centuries prior to this, only three major chiefs had died on the battlefield. Rarabi, who gave his name to the line of the Amakhosa led by Sandile, Mlau, and Chaka of the Kunukwebe, with a TSH, not to be confused with Shaka. Even Nika and Nhlambe spared each other. War between Amakhosa chiefs did not lead to the destruction of all resources, although now and again the huts of the defeated would be burned, but the defeated men, women, and children would not be killed or even expelled from their land. It was a long-standing tradition amongst Amakhosa, their spirit, to return a portion of the spoils of war to the defeated, saying, "We must not let even our enemies die with hunger." As Jeff Perez points out in his seminal work, The House of Paulo, many features of pre-colonial Amakhosa warfare were shared with other Nguni people. The short stabbing spear, battle strategy, the Khoza wings and the Zulu horns, the Khoza center and the Zulu chest of the bull. But one thing was different. The Amakhosa knew when to discard old practices that no longer worked against a new enemy, the settlers, the Trekboers, and the British. It was during the Seventh War that saw a marked shift in tactics and weapons, with the Amakhosa arming themselves with muskets and deploying their bush strategy. They did not charge an open countryside like the AmaZulu. They tended to use the geography in a more nuanced fashion, as Sir Peregrine Maitland and his soldiers were going to discover. Although in one of the upcoming battles, the Nhlambe were going to pay dearly for ignoring other Khoza chiefs' advice to only move at night and to avoid open ground. Maitland declared war on April 1st, 1846, and Lieutenant Governor John Hare launched his preemptive strike into Khoza land. It took almost 2 weeks to assemble the troops while the governor issued orders for all missionaries to leave Amakhosini. Many white traders had already been killed by this time, the rest scattered from Khoza territory. On the 11th of April, Colonel Somerset led three columns across the Great Fish River, then the Kaiskama River. He was heading towards Sandile's Great Place alongside Burnshill, the abandoned Glasgow Missionary Society station on the slopes of the Amatola Mountains. That's east of where the town of Alice is today. The British were advancing in classic British style, 125 wagons, each drawn by 24 oxen, a 5-kilometer-long column of men, machines, and animals. The dragoons were mounted on their heavy chargers, dressed in red tunics with blue forage caps. The Cape mounted rifles on their smaller Boer ponies, dressed in green tunics and brown breeches, blending into the countryside. The infantry marched behind, dressed in scarlet jackets with white cross belts and white trousers, and their cylindrical hats called Albert Shakos that tapered to protect against the sun. You can imagine the scene. Hundreds of troops on horseback and marching, the dust lifting off the trail, and very soon the infantry began to discard their thick red coats. These soldiers began this war dressed like they dressed for a European battle. By the end, they would all look very different. They replaced these Albert Shakos with forage caps or large Boer hats. They ditched their heavy backpacks for much lighter knapsacks, and they put away their leather collars. Somerset was pleasantly surprised to find no Amakhosa warrior in his way as his force arrived at Burnshill. After setting up camp there and leaving the wagons under Major John Gibson, he marched off into the Amatola Valley on the 16th of April, leading 500 men. Watching him were thousands of Amanika warriors, many armed with muskets. They began peppering the British with heavy, albeit inaccurate, fire. These were flintlocks, out-of-date weapons, but they still packed a punch. The British and the Cape Mounted Rifles were armed with the new percussion lock smoothbore muskets, featuring a brass percussion cap coated with mercury. When the hammer struck the cap, the mercury explodes and ignites the charge in the barrel. These muskets could be used in wet weather, whereas the flintlocks suffered from damp powder, and the percussion caps could be reloaded far quicker than flintlocks. The Amakhosa were now deploying their men in a classic guerrilla warfare manner, using the bush as cover and firing from a distance, or trying to lure the soldiers into these thickets like they had in previous encounters. The Amakhosa avoided open ground. It was hit and run in ambush. It was also now that Calderwood's plea to let Makoma into the ceded territory or even across the Kaiskama, and Hare's refusal was going to backfire on the British. Makoma was a highly experienced commander and recognized the British had one major weakness, their baggage train. It was under his prompting that the other Khoza commanders agreed to strike the wagons rather than aiming at the infantry. In the late afternoon of the 16th, as Somerset was toiling in the Amatola Valley, the Khoza made their move. A group of Nika warriors appeared out of the bush and seized some of the oxen back at Burnshill camp. A Peninsular War veteran with the name of Captain R. Bambrick, A soldier who'd survived Waterloo led a group of the 7th Dragoons into the bush to retrieve these oxen. He was shot dead immediately, and his body left as the cavalry withdrew. Enter Harriet Ward, stage left. She was one of the earliest women war reporters, and her writing about this incident led to the myth that Bambrick's skull was detached from his body and ended up at the home of dreaded Mpundamise war doctor Mnyeki, who used it to conjure up supernatural forces against the invaders. The taking of skulls was not a normal practice in Amakhosa warfare. It was King Hintsa Kapalo who had been decapitated by English soldiers under command of Sir Harry Smith at the Nkapara River in 1835, which had so horrified that Khosa. Harriet Skelly had married John Ward in 1831 in London. He was a military officer, and Harriet accompanied him on various postings. They had one daughter, Isabel, and lived together on St. Helena in the late 1830s. In 1842, the family travelled from Cork to the eastern frontier of the Cape and spent 5 years in the British colony there at Fort Peddie and Grahamstown, then inside the ceded territory. Harriet Ward returned to Britain in 1848. This is when she started to publish full-length books, building on previous articles and short stories. It's her description of Captain Bambrick's skull that has caused a fuss. The Grahamstown Journal and other reports at the time did not mention his decapitation, despite its editor Robert Godlinton demonizing the Khosa. Historians now don't believe the skull's story. It's a fabrication, but an important one. Harriet Ward's reports about this war were going to create quite a stir, as you'll hear. Her narratives of the Amakhosa and the Eastern Cape life were lapped up by a gratuitous audience. We'll return to skull-taking allegations later, but it's important to note that unlike the early period of British and English Amakhosa relationship, which was characterized by mutual respect, now the reinforcement of racial attitudes was cementing in the Eastern Cape. And so at this point, it's exit Harriet Ward stage right, back to the early evening of April 16th, 1846. As the shadows drew close, the Amakhosa emerged from the bush to attack the British at Burns Hill from all directions. It was only their percussion-capped muskets that saved the dragoons huddled behind the wagons. Major John Gibson was in a spot of bother, and this was going to get worse, because as night fell, he received a message from Somerset ordering him to move up to the commander's position in the Amatola Valley. That was exactly what Makoma hoped they'd do. As the AmaZulu had discovered, attacking wagons in a defensive position was suicidal. But as soon as they strung out along a trail, well, that was another story. Major Gibson began moving out of Burns Hill early next morning, the 17th. Only a few kilometres from the mission station, it all began to go wrong. The column was strung out in a defile, protected by both an advance guard and a rear guard heading towards the Kaiskamma River Drift. Sandile personally led the force of Nglika Amakhosa, who waited in the bush alongside this route. And he had taken Makoma's advice, albeit from a brother he'd clashed with so publicly. A good tactic is a good tactic, after all. Hundreds of warriors pounced on the wagons in the middle of this 5 kilometer baggage train, immobilizing them by cutting the oxen loose or killing the beasts. It was the 4 wagons at the rear of this long column that were the most important for the British. They held all the ammunition. The 250 men of the Cut River settlement, under the command of Andries Boete, they managed to drag the 4 wagons back to Burns Hill, while the wagons in the front also made it through to Somerset. But 65 wagons had been left to the Amakhosa, containing all the dragoons' wine, their dress uniforms, the regimental silver, and expensive private firearms, as historian John Labunt notes. Somerset decided wisely that enough was enough, and called off the invasion of the Amatolas. The next morning, the 18th, his force was surrounded once more by the Amakhosa, who attacked immediately, and it was only repeated volleys from his men that kept the warriors at bay. The British were now forced to conduct a fighting retreat, and another wagon was seized by Sandile's men. They fought all the way back to Block Drift over the Tumi River and lagered at Lovedale Mission Station. When the Amakhosa nation heard about this tumultuous retreat and the manner in which Sandile had won a major victory, many thought it was a perfect moment to throw caution to the wind and finally defeat the invaders. All chiefs between the Kai and Kaiskamma rivers decided to join the Amanika for 2 reasons. The first was it proved the British army could be beaten, and secondly, most Khosa were infuriated that the British had broken their treaties and invaded the Emakhosini land. Inkosi Botomani of the Madangi didn't need much convincing, although Mhala of the Amandlambe's decision to join Sandile was a bit of a surprise. He'd been regarded by the colonial authorities as extremely cautious. No longer. Tokweti of the Amambalu joined, so did Christian convert Diani Chachu of the Amantinde. Makom and his Amanjinkle took up arms, and Patu of the Amakunukwebe as well. Last episode, I explained how Patu had supported the colonials until this war, but authorities had allowed the Amamfengu to settle on his land when his brother Kama left. That convinced the traditional ally to finally break with the British and join Sandile. This invasion backfired spectacularly. Even regions where there'd been relative stability now experienced chaos. On the highlands above the Amatola Mountains, the Machachu rose up, their chief Mapasa upset that the British had been allying themselves to his enemy, the Amamtembu, under Mtarara. The Amatosa living west of the Kai mobilized virtually en masse and descended on the farms and settler villages in the ceded territory, then into the Zuurveld. The Amakunukwebe's old stomping ground, and here they were, back home, they thought. Luckily for the settlers, and unlike the Sixth Frontier War, where they had no warning, this time they managed to flee to well-defended centres. Grahamstown was filling with refugees, and Xhosa raiding parties made it all the way to Port Elizabeth. The warriors swamped the land from the Sundays River near Graaf Reinet to the Indian Ocean. Smoke swirled from burned farms, thousands of head of cattle and other livestock were looted, mission stations destroyed. Further east, across the Kai River, in what is now called the Transkei, the paramount of the Amakosa hesitated. Sarili did not join this attack. He monitored Sandile's success, but he faced a few challenges. Sarili had succeeded Hinsa, chief of the Amakaleka line, the paramount line of the Xhosa nation. He was young and tested, and here he was, living in his father's house. He had not left to pursue his own power, as was tradition, and because of this his counsellors treated him like a child, because Sarhili did not have his own cattle, nor his own great place. Feeling insecure, Sarhili waited. He'd had a few difficult years fighting against the Amampondomise, eventually overcoming them with firearms he'd purchased from English and Boer traders. The Amamtembu had tried to overthrow him, but he defeated them too. Still, he was aware that the enemies abounded, and to throw in his lot at this moment with the Western Rarabi and the Nika and Tlambe, the Kunukwebe, would be a mistake, he thought. To the west, Sandile was making merry, plundering farms and villages, routing the settlers and the British army. Patu was attacking the Amamfengu around Fort Pedi, and the British garrison nearby was besieged, running out of supplies. A relief column was sent from Grahamstown to Fort Pedi, but it ran into a major Amakunukwebe ambush in the Fish River thickets on May 21st. The escort fled, leaving 43 wagons, which the Xhosa looted, then set alight. It was one victory after another, and that was the problem. The Amakosa chiefs had used their tactics brilliantly, but now the younger warriors wanted more. They egged on their elders to move on from the successful strategy of ambushing wagon trains to more challenging targets, like the military strong points. It was one thing shooting up a wagon train, but quite another trying to seize a fortress like Fort Pedi with its 8-pointed earthworks designed to withstand artillery. Against these impressive walls, the Amakosa were going to find they had bitten off more than they could chew. What happened next is for episode 166. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about this episode. You can also contact me from there. And if you'd like, sign up for my little newsletter. Until next, Salagatli.